Thank you. Be seated.
Such as you as there are.
Most are correct.
Yeah. Court is ready to hear arguments from petitioners in Park Place versus Milo.
Okay, please report. Mr. Curry Cooksey and Mr. Joel Randall Sprout will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Cooksey will present rebuttal. Mr. Cooksey will open with the first 10 minutes.
Please support. Honored to be here before your honors today. I'm representing Doris Jones in Park Place Hospital, seeking to have the court here reverse the reversal of the summary judgment that was obtained in the trial court in a health care liability claim. I can see that the audience wasn't here to listen to us, and I'll try to be very brief. This is a health care liability claim. Lola Milo was admitted to Park Place Hospital by her family physician, Dr. Waltz, who over a period of 4 months had several other consultants treating her. Originally sued in this lawsuit were the family practitioner, Dr. Waltz, an internist who originally cared for her, Dr. Badlissy, the surgeon who operated on her twice, Dr. Fadley, and the defendants who are here before you as petitioners today. At the time of our summary judgment, the only parties that were before the court are those who are before you now. Either through non-suit or failure to obtain service, the family practitioner, the surgeon, and the original internist are not parties to this particular appeal. We believe that the summary judgment proof that was before the court at the time of the hearing establishes as a matter of law that there was no causation, that at the time of the complaint of the event, the evidence was that Mrs. Milo's condition had so deteriorated that she was probably going to die regardless of the care that she received. I don't want the court to assume that we are conceding negligence in this case, but originally in this case we filed a motion for summary judgment based upon the affidavit of Dr. Suzukin and the affidavit of Nurse Jones on the issues of standard of care and causation. The plaintiffs then responded with an affidavit by Dr. Kabalatha, which I felt raised an issue on the standard of care, but not on the causation point. We proceeded on with the discovery in the case. Dr. Kabalatha, whose affidavit was used to rebut our original motion for summary judgment, was not identified as a trial expert. Rather, the plaintiffs identified a physician named Dr. Roddy. We took Dr. Roddy's deposition, and it is his testimony that we present to you that to show as a matter of law that there's no causation here, because the plaintiff's expert testified that at the time of the complaint of event, at the time that Dr. Suzukin took over the care, began weaning the lady from her respirator, she already had only a 40% chance of survival, which translates to a 60% probability that she was going to die regardless of the treatment that she was given. I believe that places us squarely in point with the court's decision of Kramer versus Louisville Hospital, where if there's evidence that the person is probably going to die anyway, all you have done is taken away a chance of survival. There's no proximate cause there, there's no cause in fact, and we're entitled to judgment because the element of causation is missing from the plaintiff's petition.
Is the treatment that Ms. Milo was undergoing, what she died of, this heart failure and this the injury to the brain, is that something that she was originally dying from?
She was admitted with multiple gastrointestinal problems.
Would that have resulted in a heart attack and brain death?
She had two surgeries. She was not doing well. She had lots of postoperative complications. The summary judgment proof presented by the respondents goes into great detail on the standard of care, talking about how she was treated, but doesn't talk about causation. But at the time that we are talking about, we're talking about an event that occurred on August 3rd, I believe 1989, when she was in the ICU, when Nurse Jones followed Dr. Suzuki's order to wean her from the respirator. And at that time, she had respiratory difficulties. She was put back on the respirator. She remained in the ICU at Park Place Hospital for several weeks. She was transferred to Houston, where she subsequently died of a cardiac arrest again.
But my question is the heart attack, the brain damage, something that is normally in the process of dying of gangrene?
You eventually die of something. Either your lungs stop or your heart stops. She did not die as a direct consequence of the arrest that she had on August 3rd. She was resuscitated. She was left in the ICU. She was transferred later for further treatment in Houston. She had a stormy course there, and she died. There's no determination in the record of, while there is an assertion in a reply brief of anoxic brain injury on the date of that cardiac arrest, and that's not in the record.
So what was the cause of death in Houston?
The cardiac arrest, Your Honor.
Which traces
no,
back?
She has, the death certificate states that she died from a brain injury, anoxic brain injury, as a consequence of cardiopulmonary arrest.
So that had nothing to do with what she was in the hospital for originally then?
It was all a long series of complications from her original surgery.
Well, of course, life is a long series of complications.
Yes, sir.
She actually died, though, of the heart attack as a result of the treatment that she received rather than the cause of her being in the hospital in the first place.
I don't think that that's true, sir. She died. She came in a very sick woman. They operated on her twice trying to fix her. It didn't work. She didn't get better, and she had additional postoperative complications that were treated until she ultimately died. And my point is, the summary judgment proof before you is, in that sequence, we're dealing with 4 months of treatment from the time of her initial surgery until the time that she finally died in Houston. The summary judgment proof before you is, at some point during that course of treatment, she had gotten so bad that she was probably going to die regardless of what was done for her. And the testimony is that that point in time was before she was weaned from the respirator.
Well, that focuses on my question. You have a patient who is terminally ill from cancer, let's say.
Yes.
And that patient is being wheeled to the chemotherapy or something, and they lose track of the gurney, and she goes down the stairway and falls 5 flights and dies from blunt trauma. But
I
would distinguish that kind of circumstance from that.
I can distinguish that because in that case, if they were suing you for not preventing her from dying of cancer, you'd have a lost chance case. If they're suing you for depriving her of those last few minutes of her life, see, dropping her down the stairs was a separate tort that may have hastened her death. In a lost chance case, there's no evidence that the treatment actually caused the death. And what I'm stating here, Your Honor, in any case, and I think
isn't the circumstance here that the hospital defends on saying she had at some point in time, she had less than a 50-50 chance of survival.
Yes, sir.
And the opposing affidavit ignores that and simply says her cause of death was the result of this particular deal of not monitoring on the wound.
Actually, if you review Dr. Gabalas's affidavit, as my brief points out, it was not before the court because we objected to it. The court sustained the objection, and it was not really argued at the hearing on the motion for summary judgment. We were discussing Dr. Roddy's report and Dr. Roddy's deposition testimony and whether causation was an element that must be proved in a malpractice case. The plaintiff's position at summary judgment was that he was suing for malpractice, not causation, and causation didn't need to be proved. But our point is we have proved that she was probably going to die before the event that they're complaining of, which puts us into the Kramer situation, where nothing that we did or failed to do could have led to her death, because you can't meet the definition of proximate cause, which says without which the death wouldn't have occurred when it did. And so in your scenario where you drop her down the stairs when she's about to die of cancer anyway, she died, even if she died 5 minutes earlier, a jury would be entitled to determine what those 5 minutes of life were worth. There's no evidence here that we shortened her life, that we caused her any additional suffering, that we committed any torts to her other than their allegation that we killed her.
But if that treatment had caused her death following day, the case would have been different then?
If the treatment, if she had died the subsequent day, and there was evidence that but for that weaning, she could have lived for another week, another month, another year.
Well, if the evidence was that she had a 40% chance of surviving the day before, and then she died the subsequent day.
If the evidence is she only has a 40% chance to survive the day before, it doesn't matter what happens after that under Kramer, I don't believe, sir, because you can't say that without the subsequent events, she would not have died anyway. Because with 40% chance, the odds are, in our civil system, with 51% being the burden, she was going to die anyway. So
well,
you cannot, a subsequent event cannot
anyway,
be the cause of death.
We're all going to die anyway.
Yes, sir, that's true.
So 40%, there are a lot of people that live a long time. after they've been declared to have only a 40% chance of living, but they may subsequently die.
Well, Your Honor, we could have lots of philosophical discussions about the use of various statistics and numbers in litigation, but unfortunately, we've got to have predictability in the law. And the law requires certain things that have got to be set in stone and have got to be concrete. Number one, causation in Texas, the court, and I thank you for it, has adhered to causation as an element. You, in Duff versus Yellen, in the Sterling cases, you say you must prove that someone caused the harm to you. Now, we fought for 10 years, we fought the push to have a cause of action for lost chance of survival. And the reason that that fails is that if you even look into the restatement where they're talking about it, and it requires you to actually cause harm to someone, and the probability of causing the possibility of harm is just too remote and too speculative. And so the court has said, for it to be probable, it's got to be more than 50%. 50% plus is the cutoff. So if before the day that you're, before our event, and frankly, I believe that if you look at the case, I don't believe a jury would find negligence in this case, but we concede that the affidavit of Dr. Kabalatha, if it were before the court, which it were not, and if he were qualified as a critical care specialist, then perhaps he could express opinions on standard of care. I'm used to scrutiny of summary judgments in Beaumont, Texas. And so when we got the affidavit, when we got a response that had an expert, we did not have a hearing on our motion for summary judgment. The first hearing was held after we filed our supplemental motion, after Dr. Kabalatha was not identified as a trial expert. Dr. Roddy was identified as the trial expert. We took his deposition. He said this lady was probably going to die before this event. And it's important to note.
Counsel, your time has expired. And
I'm sorry.
Co-counsel,
I'm sorry.
Quite
sorry.
Have the same interest you did. So, is that any further questions?
Good morning, Your Honors. I represent Dr. George Zazukin. Dr. Zazukin is an intern, is practicing in Jefferson County. Dr. Zazukin did not become involved in this case until approximately the last 4 days before the incident occurred. He was on call for her treating physician. At the time that Dr. Zazukin treated her, Mrs. Milo had already dropped into a septic episode. She was already near death. However, he was trying to wean her from the respirator, and it was after he weaned her from the respirator that she had this cardiac arrest.
If negligence is proved in this situation, and wouldn't liability for additional medical expenses be recoverable?
Your Honor, I believe, again, even if you have a negligent act, what you have to show is that the damages suffered from that negligent act were more than 50% caused by that. And the Milos in this case did not meet that burden.
No, but in the example that one of the other judges suggested, they dropped her on the floor and they had to have an orthopedic setting of her bones. And
again, I believe there's a distinction to be made there. It is, what are the damages derived from? Are the damages derived from the falling, or are they derived from the medical negligent act?
But there would be nothing to prevent recovery for additional medical expenses that are directly related
under a survival action. I don't believe that there would be anything. Under a wrongful death action, I think nevertheless you still have to show that the death was caused more than 50% by that negligent act. And I believe that would be inconsistent with Kramer. Also, Your Honors, I believe it's an important point to bring up is that the Ninth Court of Appeals in Beaumont basically has issued a challenge to this court, and they have stated that they are not going to follow Kramer. They have tried everything that they can to do to...
There's no evidence they read Kramer.
And that's exactly the case, Your Honor. Our whole basis of our motion for summary judgment was the Kramer decision, and it was never once mentioned, however, in the Court of Appeals decision. I think their attitude was expressed...
Was it argued?
Pardon?
Was it argued?
Yes, Your Honor. It was argued. No, it was not argued at the Court of Appeals level. It was argued at the trial court level. The Court of Appeals did not grant oral argument in this case.
Was it briefed? Was it cited and briefed at the Court of Appeals?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Mrs. Sprott, my question, you responded to Judge Spector's answer by saying, well, damages are the issue. My question, I think, is is different than that. If the, in Kramer, the death was the result of the illness that the patient was seeking treatment, and when treatment began, the possibility of survival was less than 50%, and you have the conclusion in Kramer. That is exactly my question. Here you have a patient who goes in who has less than a 50% chance of survival of the illness the patient is suffering from. My question says, you take that patient, and then the patient is killed not by the illness, but by some other act. The patient, thrown down the stairs, dies. So the damages are the same. The patient has died. My question is, my question is, do you concede, first of all, that the patient would have some sort of cause of action against the hospital personnel in that circumstance?
I think it's interesting enough that I would actually cite a Beaumont Court of Appeals case when they do make that distinction, and it is the Parrott versus Caskey case, where they state that a patient would have a cause of action for those moments of life where they had a negligent, where they were suffering from that negligent act,
but they would not for the death.
For the death. And they cite the Kramer also. And in conclusion, Your Honors, I believe that this is the real reason why we are here and why the Court of Appeals did not affirm this decision, and that is in the closing statement of the Parrott versus Caskey case, Justice Burgess states, on September 10, 1993, the family of Jenny Kramer lost their day in court forever. If the voters of the state became incensed enough about the injustice, perhaps the family of Sandra Jean Parrott will not suffer the same injustice. I'm afraid that that's the real reason why we're here, not because we are making new law, but because we are simply asking this court to enforce the law as it has always been.
On another matter of jurisdiction,
yes,
why did you move for severance if you thought the order was filed?
The real reason is because the court clerk called us and said that we cannot close our file until we get a severance out because there are other parties involved. We explained to the court clerk that the other parties had never been served, never filed an answer, and therefore were not properly before the court, but the court clerk said, no, I got to do it in order to close my books, and that's the whole reason.
Did you ever have any communication with opposing counsel that suggested you thought that that was a useless act or that the timetable would start running from the earlier date?
No, Your Honor. We did not.
Did you ever have a conversation to the contrary?
No, Your Honor. There was never any discussion with that.
Anything in the record that would show...
No, Your Honor. I think we would rely on the court's own decisions, which state that once all matters in controversy are finally decided, that is when the timetable begins, and we believe that occurred on September the 10th, 1993.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
If it pleases the court, Mr. K. Omari Fullerton will present argument to the respondent.
Yeah. May it please the court, counsel. We are here today to discuss Ms. Milo's case. I think it is our position that this case really is not a lost chance case. Why is it not a lost chance case? Ms. Milo, age 32, went to Park Place Hospital for what? For an atrial hernia surgery. It's a very common patients recover from that. That's why the surgeon is not even here. She went for that specific reason. She had some respiratory problems after the surgery. Dr. Zuzukin, Nurse Jones, on August 3rd, 1989, pulled the plug on Lola Milo. That's what happened.
She'd been in the hospital for 4 months?
She'd been in the hospital, in and out of the hospital. The last admission was sometime in July.
She had two surgeries prior to that time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Did Dr. Robbie's affidavit say that at the first time Zazukin and Jones saw her, she had a 40% chance of survival?
No. No.
What did it say?
It's not an affidavit.
Well, that's his deposition testimony.
His deposition testimony stated that she probably would have had less than a 50% chance of survival because of with the other problems she started to have.
At what point, before she ever saw that doctor?
It didn't state. That's what I'm saying. It's vague. You see, it didn't. There's no time and place in that deposition. They never narrowed it down. It is vague. And we can't really grant summary judgment on vague testimony. In this case, we're talking about a specific act of a doctor. On August 3rd, 1989, he improperly weaned Ms. Marla from the respirator. And in so doing, what happened is that Ms. Marla became brain damaged. Simple. She became brain damaged. She was in the hospital from August 3rd until they decided to send her to St. Luke's Hospital. At that time, she had suffered irreversible brain damage because of the direct act of Dr. Zazukin and Doris Jones in weaning the patient. Even with the summary judgment, evidence will show where the nurse, Tiller and Willis, talk about Doris Jones in that she should have basically observed the patient. The patient was restless, but yes, and the patient was indicating to her that she did not want to be weaned, but yet still she went and she plugged the plug on this 32-year-old woman. Then she died as a result of ischemic brain damage. That's the immediate cause of death. The brain damage itself, that's what caused Ms. Marla's death, because Dr. Zazukin and Doris Jones did that.
How long did she live after that plug was pulled?
She lived until September 20th.
Several months?
About a month after. Well, she did not really live. They had to take the plug off. She died. She died.
She was brain dead?
She was brain dead on August 3rd when they pulled the plug. You see, in Kramer is dealing with terminal illness, cervical cancer. Everyone knows we have no cure for cancer in our state. But still, even say if Kramer were to apply in this case, it is our position that the nature of the doctor-patient and physician relationship, their job is to try and cure disease and injury. And if there's some possibility that they can do this, they should do it. Like in Ms. Kramer, the doctors basically ignore Ms. Kramer, they misdiagnose her condition.
Well now, counsel, are you of the opinion that if someone's on a life assist mechanism, that the physician is under some kind of obligation to continue that as long as that machine will work?
No, Your Honor. That's not the case. This case is, they could not continue. She died when the doctor took the plug off on August 3rd, 1989. So there was no reason. Technically, they were trying, but there was absolutely no reason for them really to continue to keep her on the respirator on August 3rd. 1989, because she was essentially brain dead. Prior to August 3rd, 1989, she was okay.
Well, but she was on a respirator prior to August 3rd, wasn't she?
Yes, as all most ICU patients in Texas.
And that was my question, is you think that as long as that the doctor is in some kind of obligation to keep her on under that kind of a treatment situation, as long as she could live?
They should keep her under that condition, yes, in terms of the ventilator. They should have. And this is the problem in this case, is that they prematurely weaned her. They took her off the ventilator too early. And that's why, in terms of the medical management, and Dr. Balazé cited that in his affidavit. And in terms of in our response to summary judgment, it's interesting to note that Mr. Kukski did not object to our summary judgment evidence. The only objection that he made was to Janice Willis being saying that she was not named in time as an expert witness.
Temple, are you claiming Park Place Hospital and Nurse Jones did any separate act of negligence apart from what Dr. Suzukin ordered?
Yes. Dr. Suzukin ordered the weaning prematurely.
Yes. What did Park Place Hospital do wrong?
They hired Dr. Suzukin and Ms. Jones, and they failed.
And what did Nurse Jones do wrong?
She failed to follow the patient wishes, observe her properly. The patient was restless, as the mother stated in her affidavit that she had observed that, Ms. Catherine Graham's affidavit, that her daughter was restless when she came to the hospital. She had problems, said breathing. When they took her off the respirator, she was breathing for hours, but in terms of the doctors, have stated that they should not have done it. And that's why she died from brain damage and not from sepsis or abscess, gangrene, or anything else. Immediate cause of death is ischemic brain damage. And basically, if this court were to continue down the road with Kramer and continue to follow Kramer, then basically to refuse to impose liability when physician negligently fail to effectuate this duty would declare open season and ill and injured persons, as care provider would be free of liability for even the grossest malpractice if the patient only have an even chance of survival. I think this is wrong to the people of Texas.
Is it your view that Kramer, but for it being wrongly decided, would be controlling in this case?
No, I don't think Kramer is not decided in this case. It's not. I don't think Kramer is controlling in this case, Your Honor.
Why did the Court of Appeals have jurisdiction over this case?
The Court of Appeals have jurisdiction over the case, in which they totally ignored them right from the start. Dr. Badlisi was eventually, the case was severe. Dr. Badlisi was served in the case, but he refused service. And
could you explain that?
He refused service. He was served, but he refused it.
How did you do that?
Oh, when he got the certified letter, he refused to accept the service.
Well, that's not service.
Right.
He was offered notice. Is that
right? He was offered notice, and he refused it.
Well, he was either served or not served, but you can't refuse service. See that there was no service?
Yes. And that explanation.
If there was only service on the three defendants who are here today as petitioners, then why was the order of severance necessary?
Park Place Hospital, Doris Jones and Dr. Suzukin filed a motion for severance.
Did they need to do that or not?
In my opinion, they needed to do that.
Why?
Because the case had not disposed of all the parties.
What parties had it not disposed of?
Dr. Badlisa. And also, it's not, if they had not filed a motion for severance, obviously would have to follow that other timetable. They filed a motion for severance. They said to the court, a motion is an application to the court for an order. They said to the court, in order for this judgment to become final, we need a severance. That's what they said to the court. The court agreed with them, and I followed the court.
Let's just assume that there weren't any other defendants in the case. But the court clerk required a motion for severance before entering a judgment. Would that create a different timetable? The mere fact of that filing of severance, just to move the case forward, if it was a useless act, would that set up a different timetable under our appellate rules than if the severance had not been filed?
If it did, I don't get it. Yeah.
And I'll withdraw the question.
Basically, you know, what we're asking the court to do is to affirm the Court of Appeals decision. The Court of Appeals is not, in Beaumont, is not issuing any challenges to this court, because the Court of Appeals in Beaumont ruled on the last chance issue, and they addressed that issue. They did not address the last chance issue in this case, basically because it's not really a lost chance case. It has nothing to do with it. It was a pure negligent act of Dr. Suzukin and Doris Jones that caused Lola Myla to die and depart this world. Therefore, we ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals decision.
Any other questions? Thank you, Commissioner.
Very briefly, Your Honors. It has been the respondent's position here that since they did not plead for recovery for lost chance, that this was not a lost chance case. And I believe that the lost chance doctrine does not really depend on how you plead it, but how the evidence shakes out. And if the evidence is such that you are probably going to die before the complaint of event, then it's a lost chance case regardless of how it's pleaded. And in this case, we basically pointed out that since the evidence was that the lady was probably going to die before this event, then the subsequent event could not be the proximate cause of her death. This is not a case where the plaintiffs are seeking any damages for any additional harm that occurred to her between that event and the time that she died. They're claiming the wrongful death recovery.
After I asked the question about Dr. Roddy's testimony, it looks like y'all were scurrying through the record.
Yes, sir. His deposition at page 21 through 24, and we have cited that for you in the transcript pages from the record are cited in my brief and in Mr. Sprott's brief. And he's talking about the sepsis that she had, the multi-system organ failure that she had, how sick she was before they unhooked the respirator. And he stated that even if they left the respirator on her, she only would have had a 40% chance to survive, because she had a greater than 50% chance of dying before that event occurred. And he is the one who came up with the 40%. This wasn't a leading question. We asked him what percentage, and the plaintiff's expert said 40% chance of survival before that event. In conclusion, the Beaumont Court of Appeals felt that they found evidence of causation in the death certificate, the affidavit of an LVN, and the affidavit of Dr. Gabalaza. I disagree with Mr. Fullerton. We did object, and the initial motion objected to Dr. Gabalaza, and the supplemental motion objected to Nurse Tillett. The death certificate, as we pointed out, is too remote. It talks about a death that occurs 2 months after this event. It does not relate it to that specific event. I don't think any reasonable inferences leading to that event can be raised from the death certificate. And as such, I believe there's no evidence of causation.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in this cause, and all the causes argued this morning are submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will adjourn the court.
Oye, oye, oye.